In the last episode, yet another coup allowed yet another powerful Christophian black general to become president of Haiti. And while this guy, Jean-Baptiste Richer, would not last no longer than Gerard, Guerrier, or Pierrot, he would be the last of the four presidents to rule Haiti in the transitional period between Boyer and the next guy I am about to introduce. And so, in this episode, I want to kind of wrap up the so-called transitional period and set the stage for the rule of Faustin Salouk, who will not be a one-year president. I want to conclude both the social and political revolutions which had been attempted in 1843, and I want to introduce Faustin Salouk and explain how and why he became president. Like I did with Gerard, in order to have Pierrot and Richer as separate episodes, I chose to finish off the presidency of Pierrot last episode. But in the process, I had to skip over a few important events that happened between the beginning of the coup that brought Richer to power and the surrender of Pierrot. So, like with Gerard, I have to backtrack a bit to cover those events. Part of the reason that many Boyer's backers decided to swap out Pierrot for Richer was Pierrot's appointment of a coup to a position in the administration. A coup was pretty thankful towards Pierrot for this, and so he held on to his loyalty to Pierrot, even as the rest of the nation turned towards Richer. A coup and some of his men seized a fort on the northern coast of the southern peninsula. Here, a coup made a stand with about 200 new piquettes. He was trying to reignite the social revolution which had brought down Gerard, but this time, the president had more control over the military, and so a coup didn't really stand a chance. Richer sent thousands of soldiers to meet a coup, and the soldiers stormed the fort with overwhelming force. A coup fled into the countryside, but he was pursued by the army. After a long journey, a coup took refuge in a cave. There, believing all was lost, a coup committed suicide. A coup's movement had been different from many of the revolts that had preceded it. His movement emerged from the rural peasant population of Haiti. These Haitians fought for real peasant democracy, as well as to better their own material conditions. They weren't mutinying soldiers or insurrectionist city dwellers. They weren't even really Maroons like Gaumont had been. And though a coup was now dead, his spirit would live on in both the hearts of the rural peasants and the minds of the Haitian rulers. Another peasant revolt was a terrifying prospect for this ruling elite. A coup's revolt was also very different from not just the elitist revolts, but also for many other social revolts because of its end goal. Unlike Gaumont's Maroons or any other cultivator revolts, a coup was not fighting to totally overturn the socioeconomic system. And knowing that can shine some insight into the total success that the Le Coup system had had in Haiti. To quote a paragraph written by John Henry Gonzalez, from his book, Maroon Nation, quote, "Yet despite certain parallels, the Piquet Rebellion was fundamentally different from the rebellions and wars of the Haitian Revolution. The Piquet fighters were rising up against a corrupt and racist political and economic elite, rather than an entire system of production and land tenure." In 1844, as rebel peasant armies marched through Haiti's southern peninsula, they did not burn and destroy cane fields and plantations. Indeed, there were practically no plantations left to destroy. The rebels of 1844 were reinforcing gains that had been achieved and consolidated a generation earlier. Whereas the revolutionaries of 1791 had been among history's greatest saboteurs and arsonists, a coup successfully prevented his forces from looting and destroying the areas they captured. And he observed what Michael Hector describes as a strict respect for property. This respect for property was possible because of a significant proportion of the Piquet rebels were small landowners, possessed a characteristic Haitian popular faith in land as the ultimate guarantee of freedom, dignity, and status. Slaves of Saint-Domingue, by rebelling against their owners and making war on the plantation system, had transformed themselves from human property into a landed proprietors. End quote. What he is saying here is that a coup's revolt shows a fundamental change in Haitian economics, and that a coup's revolt demonstrates the dominance of a new generation of Haitian peasants over the countryside. With his authority firmly established over Haiti, although Pierrot had not yet capitulated, Richer decided that the time was right to rule Haiti under an actual constitution, not just by right like his predecessors. To this end, Richer decided to reestablish the Haitian Constitution of 1816, with a few modifications. For one, the Secretaries of State, or what I probably should be calling the Haitian Cabinet, would be maintained. Also, the Council of State, originally created by Guerriere, would be transformed into the Haitian Senate, although its membership roles would be swapped around quite a bit. But this reinstatement of the Constitution of 1816 brought back a lot of Pétion and Boyer's constitutional authoritarianism. For example, the Senate would once again choose the president, and the president would now once again have a dominant voice in deciding the members of the Senate. Often, especially by more modern historians, this constitution is called the Constitution of 1846, but I will just refer to it as the Constitution of 1816, since the difference between the two is not big enough to warrant a name change. This reestablishment of the Constitution of 1816 marks the final, absolute, and total end of whatever kind of liberal revolution had been attempted by Herard and Dumas back in 1843. For the first, but definitely not the last time, liberalism had failed in Haiti. In the end, the first generation of Haitian liberals ended up turning on their liberal principles. Many wrote about how Haiti just wasn't ready for real democracy. And many more liberals ended up embracing authoritarianism, like Herard or Dumas. The years of drama between Boyer and Salouk ended up kind of playing out like an Haitian revolution of 1848. The common people beaten back, while the bourgeoisie liberals disheartened or turned traitor. And of course, the colored elites remained in power. So Richer himself had a relatively short, unimportant, and uneventful presidency. And as such, I think I can dispense with the year between when he became president and when he died in about a paragraph. So while sources from and about his presidency can be spotty and heavily contradicting, it seems relatively clear that Richer tried to take on a more active role in government, rather than just being a figurehead. Of course, he filled his cabinet and his senate with elite colored Boyerists like Beobron Ardouin, who became vice president of the senate, and his brother Seligny Ardouin, who became one of his ministers. But Richer seems to have acted somewhat independently of the men trying to use him as a puppet. He was a very big legislator, and he seems to have tried to reform certain aspects of the government. Some of these reforms, which, while not being democratic or anything, seemed to have annoyed his Boyer's backers. In early 1847, Richer took a trip to the Northern Department. Richer was in his 60s, and while he had never had good health, the trip to the North seems to have really hurt his health. As such, he died on February 27th, 1847, 3 days after returning from the North. While I can't really find a source from the time that claims this, many modern sources, especially those on the internet, claim that Richer may have been poisoned by his Boyer's backers as a result of his reforms. But after his death, an autopsy was performed on him. This autopsy concluded that his death was totally natural and published a report about how his organs had been destroyed from the inside. I will say, though, that the autopsy report they published does not make much sense. So while he may have been poisoned and this autopsy may have been faked, Occam's razor says that he probably wasn't, and Richer probably just died from natural causes. This would make for a good conspiracy theory, though. According to the Constitution of 1816, which had been reinstated by the late Richer, the Senate had the right to appoint the new president, who would serve for life. With the Senate trying to choose popular people who they thought they could control, the Senate ended up being divided between two candidates, neither of whom are particularly important, in a perfect tie. So Senator Beobern Ardoin proposed a third candidate, a guy who everyone could get behind, Faustin Saluk. And given that he will rule Haiti for the next decade, I think I should probably flesh out Saluk a bit. Faustin Saluk was born into slavery in southern Haiti in the mid-1880s. He was freed as a teenager as a result of, you know, the Haitian Revolution. Probably during the War of Independence, Saluk decided to join the army. Incredibly ironically, given what he is going to do over the course of his reign, Saluk fought under Pétion during the Civil War. He soon became attached to General Lamar. Remember him? He was the guy fighting the Northwest Revolt against Christophe. Saluk served as an aide-de-camp to Lamar throughout the Northwest Revolt. There is even a possibly apocryphal story that when Lamar was killed, Saluk was entrusted with bringing his heart to Pétion. With Lamar gone, Saluk was appointed a lieutenant in the cavalry guard. This began Saluk's long career, serving as a guard to many Haitian presidents. When Pétion died, Saluk was appointed to serve Boyer's wife. Side note, I've been trying to shoehorn this in since I noticed it, but actually Pétion and Boyer had the same wife. Yeah, they both ended up living with the same woman, who acted as a political advisor and unofficial wife to them both. This is especially funny because Pétion totally distrusted Boyer towards the end of his life. Anyway, despite his comfortable job serving under Boyer, Saluk was not really okay with Boyer's political ideology. So, in 1838, Saluk joined the black supremacist plot to assassinate Boyer. This will not be the last time Saluk's feelings of black supremacy will arise. When this plot was discovered, Saluk probably would have been arrested, but Boyer's wife intervened, as she had taken a liking to Saluk. Saluk languished for a while, but once instability returned, Saluk began to rise through the ranks. Saluk became a captain, then a squadron leader, and then under Richer, he was appointed commander of the palace guards. When Beobern Ardoin chose Saluk as president, he and the rest of the colored bourgeoisie believed that Saluk would be like Gruyere. Saluk was not popular or well-known, but on March 1st, the Senate chose Saluk as president of Haiti. He was chosen because the coloreds that ran the Senate thought that they could control Saluk, and that Saluk would be their puppet. There's a story that Saluk thought it was a joke when he was told he was chosen as president. But the Senate was totally wrong here. Saluk would not be their puppet. And in choosing him, the wealthy colored senators had made a fatal mistake for their regime. The transitional period was now over, and the rule of the Second Empire now begin.